Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
No one could be that irresponsible, that criminally negligent, to just leave a child on a train, could they? He runs for the corner, remembering a bodega there, one of those cramped little 24-hour groceries, where cats chase mice around the produce and disenfranchised men hang around the payphone outside. The dull pain in his shoulders become a kind of tourniquet-like tightness. The only thing that matters. I have lost the only thing that matters. All the world could die now, and he wouldn't care.
You're listening to Keith Sarabica reading from Peter Blauner's story, Going, Going, Gone, which we'll be hearing on this program of Selected Shorts. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Hi, may I tell you our specials? From our weekend of mystery stories at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, we're serving up two different adventures. Or are they perhaps nightmares? In this first one, Peter Blauner's Going, Going, Gone, everything seems to go wrong for our hero, an ordinary guy who's just trying to have some quality time with his kid during their precious hours of shared custody. The story was featured in Best American Mystery Stories of 2007. Peter Blauner lives in Brooklyn, New York, where the story takes place. The reader in Los Angeles is the transplanted New York actor Keith Sarabica.
It happens so fast. Sussman only turns his head for, what, maybe 2 seconds? To check out that hoochie mom in the low-slung Ram Riders and the spaghetti strands top. And when he looks back, his 6-year-old Ben is already on the Coney Island-bound F train, and the shiny metal doors are closing between them. Sussman pushes through the crowd of departing passengers, trying to pry the doors apart, but it's too late. The train is already starting to move. He runs alongside it, yelling, "Stop!" and gesturing wildly as Ben stares through the scratchy-eddy glass in open-mouthed confusion. But then the window slips past him, like a frame going through a film projector, and he almost collides with a pillar near the end of the platform. A seismic rumble fills the station, and he sees the white F on the back of the train receding into darkness. Going, going, gone, leaving him stranded. He pictures his heart untethered from his body, falling through space, but somehow still pulsing on its own. The morning had begun in such a tremulous note of anticipation. This was supposed to be the day when he finally assumed his proper responsibilities and proved he wasn't such a schmuck after all. For the first time since the divorce, he'd managed to get away from work and set aside a full weekend for the kid. No phone calls from clients, no answering emails, just quality father and son time. Up until 11 on Friday night with a Star Wars DVD marathon, which, truth be told, he kept watching even after Ben fell asleep 2/3 of the way into A New Hope. Field box seats from the corporate account at a Saturday afternoon Yankees game, half the innings spent at the souvenir stand, but that's what you get for taking a 6-year-old, and dinner at Junior's. 3/4 of a strawberry cheesecake slice left uneaten. But today was supposed to be the penultimate bonding experience, the maraschino cherry rescued from the bottom of the Shirley Temple glass, the long-awaited pilgrimage to Coney Island that Ben had been begging for. Sussman had been building up to it for weeks, telling the kid about the trip he'd make to Astorland every summer with his father, who'd moved the family from Bay Ridge to Long Island back when he was 7. He told Ben about the cyclone, the bumper cars, the shooting galleries in the Midway, and, of course, the Wonder Wheel. For some reason, the last attraction had meant the most to the kid. He woke up this morning to find Ben with his crayons in the kitchen, drawing a picture of a stick figure man running after a spiny Ferris wheel as it rolled down a hill. Now Sussman stands at the end of the platform, feeling a cold ripple of panic rise from the pit of his stomach. The murmur of the departed train still vibrates through the station. The only thing that matters. I have lost the only thing that matters. His chest heaves and dread worms into his veins. He looks around. Shouldn't there be a station manager on duty or a call box with a button you can push in case of emergencies? But it's still before noon on a Sunday morning in August, and the place is desolate. He calls out, "Help!" But his voice sounds thin and nasal, echoing off the tiled walls. An old bag woman on the opposite platform, her jaw working like Popeye's from over-medication, glares at him furiously, as if she's seen everything that's just happened and knows he's at fault. He starts to run, half remembering a payphone he'd once used way down at the other end of the platform for another hassled conversation with his ex. "Yes, I sent the check already. No, I can't take him next weekend. What will she say about this time? I knew it! I knew I couldn't leave him alone with you! You're such a thoughtless asshole!" He grabs the phone's gummy yellow receiver. The rusted coil slithers, and then red and green wires spill from the chrome mainframe. Broken. Of course. He drops the receiver in disgust and charges toward the stairs, blood throbbing in his ears. He pictures Ben alone on the train, a wan, frightened child in a forest of strangers. Would he think to look for a policeman or another responsible adult? Who knew what his mother had taught him to do in an emergency? He was a fragile kid at the very best of times, and the divorce had shaken him badly. He'd cowered in his bedroom when his parents fought, and had turned shy and withdrawn after the split. A bully magnet, according to his kindergarten teachers, easily buffaloed away from the more popular toys. Sussman imagines a stranger taking the child's hand and leading him off the train at some unknown stop, saying, "Mommy and Daddy are waiting for him there." He leaps up the steps two at a time, the slap of concrete in the bottom of his loafer stinging the soles of his feet. "You taking your son for the weekend?" one of the other guys in sales gawked at him Friday afternoon. "Jesus, I never even knew you'd spawned." He stops a second on the landing to catch his breath, his belt buckle digging into a flabby roll. He's terribly out of shape these days, from eating junk food on the road and skipping the gym for weeks on end. "You think somebody's going to give you their account because you're the most relaxed rep they've ever met?" he'd asked one of the newbies just last week. He swallows and sees the token booth, a football field and a half away. "No awards for the best excuse. He who hesitates is lunch." He makes another run for it, his lungs already straining, his knees audibly squeaking. He realizes he's become the stick figure from Ben's drawing, chasing the giant wheel rolling down the hill. He lifts his thighs and digs for all he's worth. The future has narrowed to this barren gray stretch of concrete. From here to the token booth. But when he gets there, the booth is empty. A small beige bag blocks the trench under the glass. For a second, he sees himself like Willem Dafoe on the poster for Platoon, falling to his knees as an enemy's bullet rips into his chest. No! He doesn't even have the luxury of despair. Every wasted second holds the potential for disaster. What's the next stop on the train? His eyes find the map on the wall and start desperately searching for the right artery through Brooklyn. Up until this second, he'd never bothered to study other routes besides the ones that take him back and forth to Manhattan. The wilderness. Though he was born here and has been renting an apartment in Windsor Terrace for 2 years since the breakup, this borough is still the unexplored wilderness to him. Threatening swatches of Fort Greene and Williamsburg have only been glimpsed fleetingly through car service windows coming home from work late at night. He sees the train cuts through Borough Park and pictures mirthless bearded Hasidim glowering down at his boy. The stops have unfamiliar names like Church Avenue, Ditmas, King's Highway. He sees Avenue X, and somehow the starkness of those black letters on the bland beige background strikes terror into his heart. He runs up the stairs for the street, drenched in sweat, his arteries beginning to constrict. But the world above ground is oblivious, just minding its own business and acting like this is just another peaceful Sunday morning on 15th Street by the park. The sidewalks are empty. Birds sing in the trees. Copies of the Sunday New York Times, sheathed in blue plastic, lie undisturbed on the doorsteps of prim, Victorian-looking brownstones and limestones. How can the people upstairs still be sleeping, or having drowsy rollover sex, or scratching their butts on the way to the bathroom with a hangover when his whole life is falling apart? How can they be so complacent? He reaches for his cell phone, but knows before his hand even touches his pocket that the thing is still sitting on the bedside table where he deliberately left it this morning, so for once he wouldn't be answering calls about work instead of spending time with his son. He imagines it, blinking dumbly, its battery life slowly ebbing away. Now he can't even call 911. Shouldn't there be one of those old-fashioned red fire department call boxes on this street? This is a nightmare in broad daylight. This is the beginning of a tragic story in the newspaper. He keeps seeing Ben's stunned little face pulling away from him. His heart squeezes, and he feels a dull pain beginning in his left shoulder. The wheel is rolling down the hill faster, picking up momentum. Blame. There must be someone else to blame. They can't all be his fault. At work, he's always had a talent for handling pressure and delivering in the clutch. But this is too much for anyone to carry. He pictures Ben surrounded by a roaming wolf pack on the train, a bunch of dead-eyed little thugs demanding the brand new Game Boy Advance he had with him. Somebody help me! His voice jiggles as he pounds on down the sidewalk, heading for 8th Avenue, looking for someone, anyone, to make a call for him and stop the trains. He sees a doughy-looking woman, gray hair sticking out from under a Yankees cap, on her way to the park with a saggy-faced mastiff on a leash. Cell phone! He calls out to her. She looks at him blankly. The pitch. He has to make a pitch to her to sell her his terrible need. Excuse me! He holds his hands out, beseeching. Do you have a cell phone I could borrow? I'm having an emergency. My child is missing. She tugs down on the bill of her cap, not meeting his eyes, she starts to pass. A time-honored urban tradition for dealing with street crazies. Stupid! A part of him is appalled. He doesn't say this sort of thing. But he can't stop himself. The wheel is spinning out of control. His whole life is on the brink of nullity, of meaninglessness, of total annihilation. He sees one brownstone without a times on its doorstep and decides the people inside must be awake. Maybe they even have children of their own. He runs up the stoop and starts ringing their buzzer.
Hello?
A groggy female voice comes out of the intercom. Automatically, he finds himself trying to picture her, like he's making a sales call. He sees a woman no longer young, not nearly old, on her first cup of coffee of the day, the type he could trap on the phone back when he was in telemarketing. He sees her in a flannel bathrobe, trying to make pancakes, moving around the kitchen, with a three-year-old clinging to her leg like a little koala bear. Hi, he says, trying to modulate and sound reasonable. I'm sorry to be bothering you. Something terrible has happened. I lost my child on the subway, and I need to call 911. Oh. For a moment, time stands still. and the wheel stops turning, leaving him suspended at the top of the arc, rocking in the breeze. Everything depends on that one syllable. He tells himself that only someone who's known the joy and pain of childbirth could say, oh, in just exactly that way. Only someone who stayed up at a feverish child's bedside until the bleak morning hours, with a damp washcloth and a dropper full of children's Tylenol, could draw the word out just so. Only someone who's filled a bathroom with shower steam at 3 a.m. for a croupy cough could be this empathetic. She understands. She knows he's telling the truth. He's going to close the deal with her. People are good. People are compassionate. This is a burrow of neighbors, not a chilly collection of anonymous souls piled on top of each other in teetering stacks like Manhattan. So he waits. And waits. Surely she'll come back. But then he notices the tightness has moved down his shoulder to his arm now. Where'd she go? Hello? He presses the talk button, knowing she couldn't have forgotten about him. Are you still there? He can almost feel a waft of cool air issuing through the speaker holes. Oh, for God's sake, at least make the call for me, he pleads, trying to get her back. Tell them there's a little boy lost on the Coney Island F train. He's wasting his time, he realizes. The deal is off. She doesn't believe him either. No one could be that irresponsible, that criminally negligent, to just leave a child on a train, could they? He runs for the corner, remembering a bodega there, one of those cramped little 24-hour groceries, where cats chase mice around the produce and disenfranchised men hang around the payphone outside. The dull pain in his shoulder has become a kind of tourniquet-like tightness. The only thing that matters. I have lost the only thing that matters. All the world could die now, and he wouldn't care. He arrives, gasping for breath, his thighs in flames from rubbing together. But somebody's already at the phone. A trim young man, upholstered with muscles, wearing a white silky do-rag and a gold cap tooth that makes him look a little like a pirate. And with him, a girl. But not just any girl. A little sex grenade. In a skimpy top and jeans low enough to reveal the jut of her hip bones. The very girl, Sussman realizes, with a sickening clench, he was ogling when Ben got on the train without him.
Yeah, but what happened to my tape, son?
The pirate is ranting.
That was my tape, yo. Don't be playing me cheap.
It's a performance. Sussman sees that right away. The boy is displaying his plumage, showing the girl that he is tough, a defender of his own rights, a man not to be trifled with.
I'm gonna kick his ass he tries to bite me. I'm serious, dog.
Excuse me. Sussman stands before him, gulping, still trying to catch his breath. I need to use that phone.
What do you mean you'll get back to me?
The pirate ignores him.
When does my copyright run out?
How can anyone be so blindly selfish, Sussman asks himself, so wrapped up in themselves? How can anybody be so unaware there are other people in the world going through their own private dramas? How can he just automatically assume that his needs are paramount and more urgent than anyone else's? I need that phone. My son is missing.
Hey, say that again, man.
The boy turns his back.
Somebody is trying to talk to me.
Sussman stares at a spot between his shoulder blades, not quite believing what he just heard. Force of will, he tells himself. Nothing gets accomplished in this world without force of will. He sees that every day in sales. Some people just won't move or react until you start to push. Before he knows what he's doing, Sussman finds himself reaching over the boy's shoulder and pushing down on the payphone's hook.
What the f-?
The boy spins around. Sussman sees the girl flinch as the boy's gold tooth catches a glint of sun, and he knows he has gone too far. The gray receiver slams into the side of his head. His brain rings as he staggers sideways from the blow. But within the pain, there's something small, hard, and rightful. He knows this is what he deserves. He clutches at the boy's forearm, trying to keep from falling, but it's too late. His muscles have lost their organizing principle. The back of his head hits the sidewalk. A flashbulb explodes inside his skull. And in the fading light of the dying filament, he sees Ben alone on the train, drawing that picture of that stick figure man chasing the wheel. As the Wonder Wheel looms into view against the gray ocean backdrop. It's over now. He's tried, given it everything he had, but he never got ahead of that wheel. It just kept spinning faster and faster so that he could never catch up with it. And if the boy somehow survives this, his father wonders if he'll just end up chasing the same thing. Avoid head-on collisions. Hi, Mrs. Sussman. You don't know me, but I have your son. The woman in dreadlocks and flip-flops is talking on a cell phone while keeping an eye on the two small boys as they steer toward each other with the bumper cars, blatantly ignoring the safety sign on the wall. Yes, he's fine. I just gave him a hot dog and put him on one of the rides. He gave me your number and asked me to call. Apparently, he got separated from your husband on the train. She watches the cars crash head-on as the kids jerk back convulsing with laughter. Well, I don't know exactly how it happened, but your boy is a real trooper, she says, holding the phone away from her ear a little as the voice on the other end turns sharp. Some hairy puke started to bother him on the train, so he got up and sat next to me because he saw I had a kid. There's grown men don't have that much sense. The cars skitter and thump across the scuffed floor, barging heedlessly into one another's paths and slamming their front ends together again with joyful abandon. Oh, don't worry about it. I'll keep him with me till you get here, she says. The only thing is, he doesn't know what happened to his father. Maybe you ought to send somebody out to look for him.
Going, Going, Gone by Peter Blauner, read for us by Keith Sarabajka. After a quick break, we'll hear a funny tale of an inadvertent art theft, read by Christina Pickles. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com. In our next mystery story, The Purple is Everything by Dorothy Salisbury Davis, the heroine of the story didn't mean to commit a crime. Far from it. What she did was more an act of loving and caring. In a career spanning over 50 years, Davis has written dozens of novels and short stories, including the Mrs. Norris and Julie Hayes series, and the collection Tales for a Stormy Night, published in 1984, the same year she was named Grandmaster by the Mystery Writers of America. The Purple is Everything is a very funny and engrossing story, especially as told by our regular shorts reader, Christina Pickles.
You are likely to say, reading about Mary Gardner, that you knew her, or that you once knew someone like her. And well, you may have, for while her kind is not legion, it endures, and sometimes against great popular odds. You will see Mary Gardner, or someone like her, at the symphony, in the art galleries, at the theatre, always well-dressed, if not quite fashionable, sometimes alone, sometimes in the company of other women, all of whom have an aura not of sameness, but of mutuality. Each of them has made, well, if not a good life for herself, at least the best possible life it was in her power to make. Mary Gardner was living at the time in a large East Coast city. In her late 30s, she was a tall, lean woman, unmarried, quietly feminine, gentle, even a little hesitant in manner, but definite in her tastes. Mary was a designer in a well-known wallpaper house. Her salary allowed her to buy good clothes, to live alone in a pleasant apartment within walking distance of her work, and to go regularly to the theatre and the Philharmonic. As often as she went to the successful plays, she attended Little Theatre and the Experimental Stage. She was not among those who believed that a play had to say something. She was interested in the submerged values. This taste prevailed also in her approach to the visual arts, a boon, surely, in the wallpaper business, whose customers, for the most part, prefer their walls to be seen but not heard. In those days, Mary was in the habit of going during her lunch hour, or sometimes when she needed to get away from the drawing board, to the Institute of Modern Art, which was less than a city block from her office. She had fallen in love with a small early Monet titled Trees Near Lavre. And when in love, Mary was a person of searching devotion. Almost daily, she discovered new voices in the woodland scene, trees and sky reflected in a shimmering pool, with more depths in the sky, she felt, than in the water. The more she thought about this observation, the more convinced she became that the gallery had hung the picture upside down. She evolved a theory about the signature. It was hastily done by the artist, she decided, long after he had finished the painting, and perhaps at a time when the light of day was fading. She would have spoken to a museum authority about it, if she had known a museum authority. Mary received from the Institute permission to sketch within its halls and often stood before the Monet for an hour, sketchbook in hand. By putting a few strokes on paper, she felt herself conspicuously inconspicuous among the transient viewers and the guards. She would not for anything have presumed to copy the painting, and she was fiercely resentful of the occasional art student who did. So deep was Mary in her contemplation of Claude Monet's wooded scene that on the morning of the famous museum fire, when she first smelled the smoke, she thought it came from inside the picture itself. She was instantly furious, and by an old association, she indicted it to a whole general of people, the careless American tourists of a foreign land. She was not so far away from reality, however, that she did not realize almost at once that there was actually a fire in the building. Voices cried out alarms in the corridors, and men suddenly were running. Guards dragged limp hoses along the floor and dropped them where they lay like great withered snakes over which people leaped, as in some tribal rite. Blue smoke layered the ceiling and then began to fall in angled swatches like theatrical scrims gone awry. In the far distance, fire sirens wailed. Mary Gardner watched, rooted and muted as men and women, visited like herself, hastened past, bearing framed pictures in their arms. In one case, two men carried between them a huge Chagall night scene in which the little creature seemed to be jumping on and off the canvas, having an uproarious time in transit. A woman took the roue from the wall beside the Monet and hurried with it after the bearers of the Chagall. Still, Mary hesitated. That duty should compel her to touch where conscience had so long forbidden it. This conflict increased her confusion. Another thrust of smoke into the room made the issue plainly the picture's survival, if not indeed her own. In desperate haste, she tried to lift the Monet from the wall, but it would not yield. She strove, pulling with her full strength, such strength that when the wire broke, she was catapulted backward and fell over the viewer's bench, crashing her head into the painting. Since the canvas was mounted on board, the only misfortune, aside from her bruised head, which mattered not at all, was that the picture had jarred loose from its frame. By then, Mary cared little for the frame. She caught up the painting, hugged it to her, and groped her way to the gallery door. She reached the smoke-bogged corridor the instant the water pressure brought the hoses violently to life. Jets of water spurted from every connection. Mary shielded the picture with her body until she could edge it within her raincoat that she had worn against the morning drizzle. She hurried along the corridor, the last, apparently, of the volunteer rescuers. The guards were sealing off the wing of the building, closing the fire prevention door. They showed little patience with her protests, shunting her down the stairs. By the time she reached the lobby, the police had cordoned off civilians, imperious as well as impervious. A policeman escorted her into the crowd, and in the crowd, having no use of her arms, they were still locked around the picture, she was shoved and jostled toward the door and there pitilessly jettisoned into the street. On the sidewalk, she had no hope at all finding anyone in that surging, gaping mob on whom she could safely bestow her art treasure. People screamed and shouted that they could see the flames. Mary did not look back. She hastened homeward, walking, proud and fierce, thinking that the city was, after all, a jungle. She hugged the picture to her, her raincoat its only shield, but a life a ready forfeit for its safety. It had been on her mind to telephone the Institute office at once. But in her own apartment, the painting propped up against the cushions on the sofa, she reasoned that until the fire was extinguished, she had no hope of talking with anyone there. She called her own office and pleaded a sudden illness, something she'd eaten at lunch, though she'd not had a bite since breakfast. The walls of her apartment were hung with what she called her potpourri. Costume prints and colour lithographs, all she had been proud to say, limited editions or artist prints. She had sometimes thought of buying paintings, but plainly she could not afford her own tastes. On impulse now, she took down an Italian lithograph and removed the glass and map from the wooden frame. The Monet fit quite well. And to her particular delight, she could now hang it right side up. As though with a will of its own, the painting claimed the place on her wall most favoured by the light of day. There is no way of describing Mary's pleasure in the company she kept that afternoon. She could not have taken her eyes from the picture at all, except for the joy that was renewed at each returning. Reluctantly, she turned on the radio at 5 o'clock so that she might learn more of the fire at the Institute. It had been extensive and destructive. An entire wing of the building was gutted. She listened with the remote and somewhat smug solicitude that one bestows on other people's tragedies, to the enumeration of the paintings which had been destroyed. The mention of trees near Lavre startled her. Full moment later, she realized the explicit meaning of the announcer's words. She turned off the radio and sat a long time in the flood of silence. Then she said aloud, tentatively, "Oh, yes, you are a thief." But she did not mind at all. Nothing so portentous had ever been said about her before, even by herself. She ate her dinner from a tray before the painting, having with it a bottle of French wine. Many times that night she went from her bed to the living room door until she seemed to have slept between so many wakenings. At last she did sleep. But the first light of morning fell on Mary's conscience as early as upon the painting. After one brief visit to the living room, she made her plans with the care of a religious novice, well aware of the devil's constancy. She dressed more severely than with her fashion, needing herringbone for backbone. The ridiculous phrase kept running through her mind at breakfast. In final appraisal of herself in the hall mirror, she thought she looked like the headmistress of a girls' school, which she supposed satisfactory to the task before her. Just before she left the apartment, she spent one last moment alone with the Monet. Afterward, wherever, however the Institute chose to hang it, she might hope to feel that a little part of it was forever hers. On the street, she bought a newspaper and confirmed the listing of trees near Havre. Although that wing of the Institute had been destroyed, many of its paintings had been carried to safety by way of the second floor corridor. Part of the street in front of the Institute was still cordoned off when she reached it, congesting the flow of morning traffic. The police on duty were no less brusque than those whom Mary had encountered the day before. She was seized by the impulse to postpone her mission, an almost irresistible temptation, especially when she was barred from entering the museum unless she could show a pass, such as had been issued to all the authorized personnel. "Of course I'm not authorized," she exclaimed. "If I were, I shouldn't be out here." The policeman directed her to the sergeant in charge. He was at that moment disputing with the fire insurance representative as to how much of the street could be used for the salvage operation. "The business of this street is business," the sergeant said, "and that's my business." Mary waited until the insurance man stalked into the building. He did not need a pass, she noticed. "Excuse me, officer. I have a painting, lady." He drew the long breath of patience. "Yes, ma'am?" "Yesterday, during the fire, a painting was supposedly destroyed. A lovely small Monet caught..." "Was there now?" the sergeant interrupted. Lovely small Monets really touched him. Mary was becoming flustered in spite of herself. "It's listed in this morning's papers, having been destroyed, but it wasn't. I have it at home." The policeman looked at her for the first time with a certain compassion. "On your living room wall, no doubt," he said with deep knowingness. "Yes, as a matter of fact." He took her gently but firmly by the arm. "I'll tell you what you do. You go along to police headquarters on 57th Street. You know where that is, don't you? Just tell them all about it, like a good girl." He propelled her into the crowd and there released her. Then he raised his voice. "Keep moving. You'll see it all on the television." Mary had no intention of going to police headquarters, where she presumed men concerned with armed robbery, mayhem, and worse were even less likely to understand the subtlety of her problem. She went to her office and throughout the morning tried periodically to reach the museum curator's office by telephone. On each of her calls, either the switchboard was tied up or his line was busy for longer than she could wait. Finally, she hit on the idea of asking for the Institute's public relations department, and to someone there, obviously distracted, Mary could hear parts of three conversations going on at the same time. She explained how during the fire she had saved Monet's trees near Le Havre. "Near where, madam?" the voice asked. "Lavre," Mary spelled it. "By Monet," she added. "Is that two words or one?" the voice asked. "Please transfer me to the curator's office," Mary said, and ran her fingers up and down the lapel of her herringbone suit. Mary thought it a wise precaution to meet the Institute's representative in the apartment lobby where she first asked to see his credentials. He identified himself as the man to whom she had given her name and address on the phone. Mary signaled for the elevator and thought about his identification. Robert Attlebury III. She'd seen his name on the museum roster. Curator... she couldn't remember. He looked every inch the curator, standing erect and remote while the elevator bore them slowly upward. A curator, perhaps, but she would not have called him a connoisseur. One with his face and disposition would always taste and spit out, she thought. She could imagine his scorn of things he found distasteful, and instinctively she knew herself to be distasteful to him. Not that it really mattered what he felt about her. She was nobody. But how must the young, unknown artist feel, standing with his work before such superciliousness? Or had he a different mien and manner for people of his own kind? In that case, she would have given a great deal for the commonest of his courtesies. Everything seems so extraordinary in retrospect, Mary said, to break the silence of their seemingly endless ascent. How fortunate for you, he said. Mary thought perhaps it was. When they reached the door of her apartment, she paused before turning the key. Shouldn't you have brought a guard or someone? I am someone. He looked down on her as from Mount Olympus. Well, Mary resolved to say nothing more. She opened the door and left it open. He preceded her and moved across the foyer into the living room and stood before the Monet. His rude directness oddly comforted her. He did, after all, care about painting. She ought not to judge men, she thought, from her limited experience of them. He gazed at the Monet for a few moments, and then he tilted his head ever so slightly from one side to the other. Mary's heart began to beat erratically. For months she had wanted to discuss with someone who really knew about such things her theory of what was reflection and what was reality in trees near L'Havre. But now that her chance was at hand, she could not find the words. Still, she had to say something casual. The frame is mine, she said, but for the picture's protection, you may take it. I can get it the next time I'm at the museum. Surprisingly, he laughed. Maybe the better part of that, he said. I beg your pardon. He actually looked at her. Your story is ingenious, madam, but then it was warranted by the occasion. I simply do not understand what you're saying, Mary said. I have seen better copies than this one, he said. It's too bad your ingenuity isn't matched by a better imitation. Mary was too stunned to speak. He was about to go. But it's signed, Mary blurted out, and feebly tried to direct his attention to the name on the upper corner. Which makes it a forgery, doesn't it? He said almost solicitously. His preciseness, his imperturbability in the light of the horrendous thing he was saying, etched detail into the nightmare. That's not my problem, Mary cried, giving voice to words she did not mean saying, what amounted to a betrayal of the painting she so loved. Oh, but indeed it is, indeed it is. And I may say a serious problem if I were to pursue it. Please do pursue it. Again he smiled just a little. That is not the Institute's way of dealing with these things. You do not like Monet, Mary challenged desperately, for he had started towards the door. That's rather beside the point, isn't it? You don't know Monet, you can't, not possibly. How could I dislike him if I don't know him? Let me tell you something about Monet. He turned back to the picture and trailed a finger over one vivid area. In Monet, the purple is everything. The purple, Mary said. Ah, yes, you're beginning to see it yourself now, aren't you? His tone verged on the pedagogic. Mary closed her eyes and said, I only know how this painting came to be here. Now, I have rather more important matters to take care of, and again he started towards the door. Mary hastened to block his escape. It doesn't matter what you think of Monet, or of me, or of anything. You've got to take that painting back to the museum and be made a laughing stock when the hoax is discovered. He set an arm as stiff as a brass rail between them and moved out of the apartment. Mary followed him to the elevator, now quite beside herself. I shall go to the newspapers, she said, I think you might regret it. Now I know. I understand. Mary saw the elevator door open. You were glad to think the Monet had been destroyed in the fire. Savage, he said. Then the door closed between them. In time, Mary persuaded, and it wasn't easy, certain experts, even an art critic, to come and examine her Monet. It was a more expensive undertaking than she could afford. All of them seemed to expect refreshments, including expensive liquors. Her friends fell in with Mary's hoax, as they came to call her story, and she was much admired in an ever-widening and increasingly esoteric circle for her unwavering account of how she had come into possession of a genuine Monet. Despite the virtue of simplicity, a trait since childhood, she found herself using words in symbolic combinations, the language of the company she kept. And people far wiser than she would say of her, how perceptive, or what insight, and then pour themselves another drink. One day, her employer, the great man himself, who prior to her acquisition had not known whether she lived in propriety or in sin, arrived at her apartment at cocktail time, bringing with him a famous art historian. The expert smiled happily over his second scotch, while Mary told again the story of the fire at the Institute and how she had simply walked home with the painting because she could not find anyone to whom to give it. While she talked, his knowing eyes wandered from her face to the painting, to his glass, to the painting, and back to her face again. "Oh, I could believe it," he said when she had finished. "It's the sort of mad adventure that actually could happen." He set his glass down carefully where she could see that it was empty. "I suppose you know that there's never been an officially complete catalogue of Monet's work." "No," she said, and refilled his glass. "It is so, unfortunately. And the sad truth is that quite a number of museums today are hanging paintings under his name that are really unauthenticated." "And mine," Mary said, lifting a chin she tried vainly to keep from quivering. Her guest smiled. "Must, you know." For a time after that, Mary tried to avoid looking at the Monet. It was not that she liked it less, but that now she somehow liked herself less in its company. What had happened, she realized, was that, like the experts, she now saw not the painting, but herself. This was an extraordinary bit of self-discovery for one who had never had to deal severely with her own psyche. Till now, so far as Mary was concerned, the chief function of a mirror had been to determine the angle of a hat. But the discovery of the flaw does not, in itself, effect a cure. Often it aggravates the condition. So with Mary. She spent less and less time at home, and it was to be said for some of her new-found friends that they thought it only fair to reciprocate for having enjoyed the hospitality of so enigmatically clever a hostess. How often has she been counseled as a girl by parent and teacher to get out more, see more people? Well, Mary was at last getting out more, and in the homes of people who had felt free to comment on her home and its possessions, she too felt free to comment. The more odd her comment, the nastier, she would once have said of it, the more popular she became. Oh, yes, Mary was seeing more people, lots more people. In fact, her insurance agent, who was in the habit of just dropping in to make his quarterly collection, had to get up early one Saturday morning to make sure he caught her at home. It was a clear, sharp day and the hour at which the Monet was most luminous. The man sat staring at it, fascinated. Mary was amused, remembering how hurt he always was that his clients failed to hang his company calendar in prominence. While she was gone from the room to get her checkbook, he got up and touched the surface of the painting. Ever think of taking out insurance on that picture? He asked when she returned. Do you mind if I ask how much it's worth? It cost me a great deal, Mary said, and was at once annoyed with both him and herself. I'll tell you what, the agent said. I have a friend who appraises these objects of art for some of the big galleries, you know. Do you mind if I bring him round and see what he thinks it's worth? No. I don't mind, Mary said in utter resignation. And so the appraiser came and looked carefully at the painting. He hedged about putting a value on it. He wasn't the last word on these 19th century impressionists, and he wanted to think it over. But that afternoon, he returned just as Mary was about to go out, and with him came a bearded gentleman who spoke not once to Mary or to the appraiser, but chattered constantly with himself while he scrutinized the painting. Then with a he took the painting from the wall, examined the back, rehung it, but reversing it top to bottom. Mary felt the old flutter interrupt her heartbeat, but it passed quickly. Even walking out of her house, the bearded gentleman did not speak to her. She might have been invisible. It was the appraiser who murmured his thanks, but not a word of explanation. Since the expert had not drunk her whiskey, Mary supposed the amenities were not required of him. She was prepared to forget him, as she had the others. It was easy now to forget them all. But when she came home to change between matinee and cocktails, another visitor was waiting. She noticed him in the lobby and realized, seeing the doorman say a word to him just as the elevator door closed off her view, that his business was with her. The next trip of the elevator brought him to her door. "I've come about the painting, Miss Gardner," he said, and offered his card. She had opened her door only as far as the latch chain permitted. He was representative of the Continental Assurance Company Limited. She slipped off the latch chain. Courteous and formal, behind his double-breasted suit, he waited for Mary to seat herself. He sat down neatly opposite her, facing the painting, for she sat beneath it erect and, she hoped, formidable. "Lovely," he said, gazing at the Monet. Then he wrenched his eyes from it. "But I'm not an expert," he added, and gently cleared his throat. He was chagrined, she thought, to have allowed himself even so brief a luxury of the heart. "But is it authenticated?" she said, as much as she would once have thought. "Fie on you." "Sufficient to my company's requirements," he said. But don't misunderstand. We're not proposing to make any inquiries. We're always satisfied in such delicate negotiations to just have the painting back." Mary did not misunderstand, but she certainly did not understand either. He took from his inside pocket a piece of paper, which he placed on the coffee table, and with the tapering fingers of an artist or a banker or a pickpocket, he gently maneuvered it to where Mary could see that he was proffering a certified check. He did not look at her and therefore missed the spasm she felt contorting her mouth. "The day of the fire," she thought, but the words never passed her lips. She took up the check in her hand. $20,000. "May I use your phone, Miss Gardner?" Mary nodded and went into the kitchen, where she again looked at the check. It was a great deal of money, she thought wryly, to be offered in compensation for a few months' care of a friend. She heard her visitor's voice as he spoke into the telephone, an expert now, to judge by his tone. A few minutes later, she heard the front door close. When she went back into the living room, both her visitor and the Monet were gone. Sometime later, Mary attended the opening of the new wing of the Institute. She recognized a number of people she had not known before and whom she supposed she was not likely to know much longer. They had hung the Monet upside down again. Mary thought of it after she got home, and as though two rights must surely right a possible wrong, She turned the check upside down while she burned it over the kitchen sink.
That was Dorothy Salisbury Davis's story, The Purple is Everything, read for us by Christina Pickles. And here is Dorothy Salisbury Davis commenting on the work, which is one of her favorite stories.
It is one of my favorites, but it's out of the main line. It doesn't have a, shall I say, the compulsion of a true mystery. I've always, let's say, hovered between a straight story and a mystery story. But it was a gift. A friend, Margaret Manners, who is long gone, at lunch, she said with great glee, "I have a wonderful idea on how to steal a painting." And she told me what the idea was. And I said, "I want it." And that's about how it went. It wasn't long after there had been a fire at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Some paintings were destroyed, I think. I'm not sure of that. That might have been my invention. And why did she have the notion that the painting was upside down? I stood in front of a Monet, probably in the Museum of Modern Art, and thought I would have seen it just as well standing on my head. The mystery is not very strong. But I learned quite a while later, you know, that it got to be handed around in certain museums in the country because it did make fun of their own pretensions here or there. They delighted in it, and so, of course, that extra delighted me. I liked it because I had fun.
The author, Dorothy Salisbury Davis. This radio program is now available as a free podcast, so you can subscribe and listen to the download on your computer or MP3 player anytime, anywhere. Subscribe today on iTunes or at npr.org or pri.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is Roger Calloway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the best American short stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Support for this program also comes from Audiophile Magazine. For audiobook information and reviews, visit audiophilemagazine.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.